Well, I just want to begin by saying a thank you to all of you. The last few minutes have felt very quintessential to my experience of being here the last few days. My voice is feeling a little weak this evening, so I decided that I wouldn't sing along. But it's one of those experiences that you don't get very often where you get to actually listen to the congregation sing over you. And it was glorious. It was glorious. It was just glorious. Thank you very much for your faith and your hope and your proclamation of our Lordship's kingdom that will last forever. I also want to say, since this is the last time I'll be up in front of y'all, I just want to also say thank you just for welcoming me into what is clearly a fraternity with lots and lots of years, clearly a history. I'm certainly the newcomer on the block, and you've treated me very graciously, and I very much appreciate it. And I want to say particularly thanks to John. From the very first phone call I ever got about this, John has been nothing but gracious. The leadership that you just saw and that you all know and experience, I've experienced with every phone call, every email, every bit. John, thank you very, very much. Very much. I'm going to work through some material tonight, and then I will leave some time for questions and answers, because if I don't, Dale Bruner will haunt me. He's going to hunt me down. And you will be first, Dr. Bruner. Your question will be first. So if not, then raise your hand and yell or something. But I also want to set the context for what I'm about to say tonight with a little bit of background about my own history. We've been joking about the Urs and the German part of Bolsinger. Well, the last German in my family, I think, was the original Bolsinger. Some guy in the 1760s, I have a cousin who chased it all the way back, who came into this country. And there's some place in Pennsylvania that has Bolsinger as a name somewhere. The heritage that I claim most joyfully is my mother's side. I'm Italian. My grandfather's name was Guido Evangelisti. That's true. It's just a true story. My grandfather is Guy the Evangelist. Really, that's his name. To be honest, I like to say that I'm related to St. Francis. And I love being Italian. I love every bit about my Italian heritage. I grew up being babysat at my grandmother's Italian restaurant. So when I was 4 and 5, I was the punky little fat kid saying, "Grandma, could we have more ravioli for lunch?" And so I had these incredibly rich memories of my heritage. Matter of fact, my grandmother passed away just a few years ago, and I literally believed that I would never taste her ravioli ever again. And a couple years ago, we went and we visited Androcoli, the little village outside Lucca where my grandfather came from, and I ended up having a meal one night, and it was my grandmother's ravioli. And I burst into tears, right? Because how rich the memories are. It's just deep and meaningful to me. And I love being Italian. But here's the one problem I have with my Italian heritage. It's that my grandfather died before I was born. You see, if you eat like those Italians, you don't live very long. And so now, being a person who's approaching my grandfather's age, I find myself asking questions all the time about how I can affirm this part of me that I love that can sometimes be actually dangerous to your health. And so I find myself, and I like to cook, and I find myself adapting my grandfather's recipes so that I can live longer. And so that, because I would like to see my grandchildren. And I find that's sometimes the way I feel about the church. You know, my wife and I both work as coaches for TAG Consulting. My wife does work with women in ministry, and before she was a marriage and family therapist who worked a lot with pastors and their families. And one night she came home just kind of broken about the way that a pastor was struggling with the congregation. And, you know, and we had this conversation, and I don't remember which one of us said it first, but I remember saying, you know, nobody ever left the ministry because they got bored of preaching the gospel, right? No one ever leaves the ministry because they said, you know, I'm not going to hear one more person confess their sin and repent and come back to Jesus. No one ever leaves the ministry because they say, I'm never doing another funeral. Because we know that's holy ground. And if we have a moment to be in the middle of those circumstances, we'll walk into hospital rooms. We've had to be the kinds of people who have had to, like, be with parents when their children died and children when their parents died. We have to walk into some of the holiest and hardest experiences of human life, and we take it on gladly. But people are leaving the ministry in droves. The statistics are so outrageous, I don't even want to quote them, but it's like in the hundreds every month of people who said they were going to be in full-time ministry and have left the ministry. And they never leave over those things. They leave because of the way churches work or don't work, because of the discouragement. And what I find myself wanting to do as a person who is, and I am the It Takes a Church guy. My dissertation was all about Trinitarian spiritual formation and about how it takes a community of God's people to transform souls into the likeness of Christ so we can complete the mission of Christ. What I find myself doing over and over and over again is coming back and going, the way we do church and the way church functions and works in a kind of a practical ecclesiology, well, it's not always good for our health. And certainly not good for the ministry. And so I find myself now working in this area of leadership development being incredibly important to me, because I find there's an opportunity here to think about how can I help support this church that I love, and how can I help it adapt to a changing world so that maybe it will actually become more vibrant, more alive, and more real. Margaret Wheatley, another one of the leadership science people, says, the primary way to prepare for the unknown is to attend to the quality of our relationships, to how well we know and trust one another. Now, for most of us as Presbyterians, we would take this, we would write this, we would tweet this, we'd put this on our Facebook pages. We would certainly send this out to our sessions. We would claim this. It's about our relationships, right? It's about being relational. But I want you to notice what she says next. She says, there's one core principle for developing these relationships. People must be engaged in meaningful work together if they're to transcend individual concerns and develop new capacities. I don't know anything about Margaret Wheatley's religious background, but what she's describing to me is what I understand as the community of God's people involved in the mission of Christ. That when we learn to trust each other is when we learn to grow and when we do the work of Christ with each other. And it's in the middle of doing the work of Christ, the mission of Christ, that we also find ourselves more and more transformed to be like Christ. And so what I want to talk about today, I just want to end these three times. I've talked about the idea of adaptive principles. Yesterday, I talked about the adaptive process. Today, I want to talk about being adaptive persons. What does it take of us to become the kinds of people who can lead our churches into uncharted territory? What's it take of us to be able to become those kinds of leaders who are able to disappoint our congregations while loving them, taking them with it on the journey, challenging them and caring for them, regulating the heat so that there's enough heat to see transformation, but being careful about the reality that we love these people and we're not going to scorch them because we don't want to be thrown out, and neither we don't want them thrown out either. This art of leadership at the very core of it. What is the work that we are to do? It's the work of the Trinity. It's the work of the God who is love, who is in relationship with one another, who was not satisfied to simply be in relationship with one another. This is Rublev's icon. I for years, this is what I would go around speaking to people about. This was the icon that was on my desk for 9 years as I wrote my dissertation and as I rewrote it into my book, It Takes a Church to Raise a Christian. I won't spend much time with you on it, but it's a ton of fun if you ever want to just do it over, you know, coffee or something someday. But the key to the icon is that we have the image of God as a Trinity. Three people in divine relationship together in shared authority, shared leadership, shared revelation. But the most powerful part of the icon is the empty part of the table. If you go to Leningrad or to the places where it's put in giant life size and you stand before it, literally you find yourself invited into that spot right here in the middle, this spot where that little square points to your presence, to God's presence. And you're invited in the way that Henry Nouwen says Jesus invited his disciples, with the phrase, can you drink the cup? See, the cup in the center of the table is the point. The cup of the love of God poured out to the world, the cup of suffering for the sake of the world. God wasn't just a happy little small group that allows you to come to the table and sit and enjoy fellowship with him. To join the fellowship of God is to join the mission of God. Trinitarian leadership is about gathering people to be a community for the sake of the mission of Jesus Christ. It's the mission over and over and over again. God's mission to claim and heal God's world. Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he said this, he breathed on them and he said to them, receive the Holy Spirit. Most of us know that this word here for send is the word where in the Latin we get the word mission. This is the apostolate, the mission, the sending of the people of God. This is the Pentecost moment in the Gospel of John. This is when we are told that we are participating in the very work of Christ that has been proclaimed from the very beginning of the ages. You know, growing up at Hollywood Press, I heard a lot about the cross of Christ and the teachings of Paul to teach me how to live out the cross of Christ. But I didn't always hear, as Dale pointed to today, all the stories of the Old Testament in the way that, you know, the story that Paul understood was being laid out in the New Testament is the story of God who from the very beginning was bringing his redemption, his healing to his world through his people. N.T. Wright says that when it talks about the righteousness of God has been revealed, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for salvation to all who believe, right? For the righteousness of God has been revealed. He says that when he talks about that righteousness, what he's talking about is that people being conformed, to the image of God for the purpose of participating in the mission of God. The creation, the fall, Israel, big chapter. Jesus, church. The righteousness of God, according to N.T. Wright, is God's promise to fulfill his covenant, to heal his world through his people himself. God is personally healing his world through his people. And the great story is how the God of Israel comes and becomes the Savior and King of the whole world. And the church, the people with his own spirit within him, are proclaimed into the world to live out that mission. Ronald Heifetz says, leadership is to help a people to grow so they can face their biggest challenges. What's our biggest challenge? It's the mission of Christ. It's so that the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ, and he shall reign. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. And until that is done, we're not done. And every single congregation lives as a cell that is meant to fulfill that mission. For those whom he foreknew, good Presbyterians, right? He also predestined to live with him in heaven for eternity. No. For those whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his son so that he might be the firstborn within a large family. Family. This is Abraham language. The family of God whose responsibility is to what? Bless the families of the world. This is the first competing value found in the scriptures, that the people of God have got a mission, that there's a family business. And this is one of the first things we discover as pastors, isn't it? Right? That the hardest part about being a pastor is that it's not just a business. I've had people say to me, Todd, why do you talk about all this business stuff? This is organizational systems. Interestingly enough, all the stuff that I've shared with you today comes from people who are mostly Jewish thinkers, interestingly enough. I think there's something about a Jewish systemic worldview that resonates. And the notion of families. And here's the families that have a purpose. Abraham, you're going to be a great family, but through you, all the families of the world are going to be blessed. We are the people who've been adopted into God's family so that we might be able to proclaim the greatness of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light, to reveal that God is the one who is redeeming and healing the world. As a pastor, I'll often say, you know, the hard part about being a pastor is being in the middle of a family business. You know, it's not just a family. You got to make hard decisions. And we talked about some of that yesterday. And on occasion, God does good things. And sometimes those decisions turn out amazing. But on occasion, you know, the so-and-so or the good friend, either one, who you might have to fire on Tuesday, could be coming to Thanksgiving dinner on Thursday. And this is what makes this so hard. Peter Drucker famously said that the most difficult jobs he believed were jobs about were hospital administrator, university president, small town mayor, and pastor. And it's not because we work harder. He said because we have complex boundaries and complex stakeholders. I was with Max Dupree and with a group of leaders at the Dupree Center of a group of pastors. And we were doing what sometimes we pastors do, and we were talking about how hard we work and how people in our congregation says, nobody works harder than you. And you know, you work harder than other people. And Max Dupree, this is an awesome moment. He turns around, he listens to us, and here's Max Dupree, you know, leadership is our leadership jazz. You know, they name a whole center of him at Fuller. And he looks at me and goes, you know, honestly, you guys don't work any harder than any middle manager in my company. You know, most of you don't have to travel if you don't want to. Most of you don't have to take, you know, relocation. I mean, except for the Methodists, you do. But, you know, most of, you know, like, you know, most of, I mean, you guys work hard, but you don't work harder than other people. What makes our job hard isn't that we work so hard. What makes our job hard is it's so complex. It's what Ed Friedman calls an emotional field. And we're always dealing with these complex issues at all times. And they relate to our own internal complexity. We're part of it also. You know, the so-and-so who's driving you crazy on the session is probably the person who reminds you of your mother. And you can't say that on session, but isn't it interesting how many times we find people who drive us literally back to our own family of origin issues over and over and over again. Interestingly enough, Karl Barth, in his Marks of Reconciliation, I spent some time with Daryl Guter, and he pointed me to this passage in Karl Barth. Karl Barth, when he talks about the essence of the church, the essentials, you know, in a section on Essay and Adiaphora, he basically says there's three marks of reconciliation. Justification. Do we believe, does the church believe in the justification of people by the blood of Jesus Christ, by faith alone? Sanctification. Do we believe that only through the power of the Holy Spirit and the Word of God can we become like Christ? Justification, sanctification. But Barth adds a third one, vocation. Vocation. Just as much an essential as justification and sanctification is the church living out its calling? We're not orthodox if we're not apostolic. We are not faithful to the essentials if we're not carrying out the mission. And as Guter himself writes, he says that God's calling of a particular people is for God's saving purposes for the world. Vocation is of fundamental ecclesiological importance in the theology of reconciliation. What's our family business? The mission. And it's the mission of Christ, and becoming people who are more effective in the mission of Christ is this part of our witness. So Guter asks, how does the church truly regain its understanding of itself as a called and sent? Remembering that the term mission means, in fact, sending. How do we regain it? Or as Newbegin asks, if Western societies have become post-Christian mission fields, how can traditional churches become then missionary churches? So with apologies to those of you who wished I would have done Moses and Joshua, I'm going to go back to Lewis and Clark. And I'm going to use Lewis and Clark again as an analogy, and I want to put you up there on that mountain. On that place where they were looking for the very first time at the Rocky Mountains, and ask the question, why didn't they turn back? They could have. They missed family. They missed friends. They could have gone back. They would have accomplished their mission. They would have been able to say to the president, there is no water route. Why didn't they turn back? What kept them at this moment from a failure of nerve? Why did they press on and press on at the risk of their own deaths? And what was it about? Remember the first night? At the moment of crisis, you'll not rise to the occasion. You'll default to your training. So the question that I want to ask is, how had they trained for this moment? And how can we train for ours? One of my life goals for the rest of my life is to begin to think about and help the church rethink the way in which pastors are trained. How can we be trained for the field that's in front of us? For the circumstance that's in front of us, for the uncharted territory, how can we prepare ourselves to be part of a generation that is going to see the death of Christendom and have the opportunity to witness to Christ in the new day and new age? I believe we have this opportunity, and it's time we rethink the way we're trained. So here I'm going to give you just tonight three what I call rules for uncharted territory, three things we have to be prepared to be prepared in ourselves in order to be able to be adaptive transformational leaders. Rule number one, leadership is about transformation. Transformation that starts with the leaders. Rule number two, no one goes into uncharted territory alone. And rule number three, transformation is fueled by trust. I believe they're deeply theological, deeply biblical, and also profoundly systemic. This is the model that I'm working on. This will be the model that I'm developing and that I'll be working on. I'll take you just briefly in a high-level overview through it. I believe transformational leadership is the intersection of three things: technical competence, certain sets of skills that we must have; relational congruence, the way in which we do relate and care for people and be congruent with both our relationships with people and our mission; and adaptive capacity. The transformational leadership begins in technical competence. I want to talk a bit about Lewis and Clark and their competence. The leadership is validated in relational congruence. When trust is extended, a core is formed, and the leadership becomes transformational with adaptive capacity. And that's truly when we become a core of discovery, ready for the uncharted territory. Remember, Heifetz says, leadership is energizing a community of people toward their own transformation. This is the place where we as pastors who remember places like Ephesians 4 should be immediately shouting out amen. Our job is to equip the saints for the work of ministry, right? Our job is not to be the ministers. Our job is to be the ones who prepare and equip the church to give back to the priesthood of all believers, to say to them, you are the people, you're the people of God, you're the one that is sent. Who's the apostle? The apostle to the world is the church. Missional means your church is an apostle. And the central organizing principle of each congregation, if it's a missional church, is the mission of Christ to be able to extend as God has called them. It's energizing a community of people toward their own transformation in order to meet their greatest challenges, the challenges of the Great Commission. So rule one, number one, leadership is about transformation, and transformation that starts with the leaders. So let me tell you a story. Part of the reason why I got into this is because I did a sabbatical. And in my sabbatical, I got one of those amazing Lilly Endowments. And I wrote the Lilly Endowment Foundation, and I said, look, here's the deal. I've been here 9 years. I'm going into my 10th. Our church is doing wonderfully. I'm not burned out. I don't need a break. I'm not discouraged. I'm not reconsidering my call. I don't need any extra help or attention. Here's what I want to figure out. What I want to do is I want to take some time away. I didn't have the term get on the balcony, but take some time away, and I want to ask the question, how can a healthy church, a church that has recovered, a church that's gone from losing half its members and been broken in half, a church that has torn down all of its buildings in order to reach out to a new generation, a church that's seen growth and strength and vibrancy and vitality not become complacent? How can a church that stay healthy and move into mission? And they gave me a grant. And I basically got a wonderful few months of tooling around reading N.T. Wright and traveling to places and studying. It was wonderful. And when I came back the next year, we began to talk about these things, and I got a coach, and the coach began to work with me. And at the end of the next year of implementing the stuff we were talking about, we were $100,000 to the black. It's the first time in my life. Some of you go to churches, you're like, big deal, we get that overage every year. Others, I'd never seen it. I've never seen anything like that. We had an extra $100,000. And I was sitting here talking to my leaders saying, guys, we talked about growing in mission, doing new initiatives, planting a Hispanic congregation, starting a community resource center, becoming a church that cares deeply about investing in pastors. We got an extra $100,000. What do you want to do? And my session looked at me and said, put it in the bank. Guys, we're really doing really well. We've got all these things that are going really, really well. We're doing 100,000, what? And it was one of those moments where I could see it in their eyes. You know those moments you've seen it? Like the markers are good, the numbers are good, the thing's up. But what I watched was the flicker in the eye of my elders who were looking at me going, yeah, I'm not into this. And I couldn't figure out what it was because everything told me we were doing great. And so I went to the guy who was coaching me, and I said, you know what, we've got 100,000. I'm telling the whole story. And he basically says to me, I think you guys got a vision problem, Todd. I think you guys need a new vision for the church. And you know what? I knew this is what we didn't have. I knew we didn't have a vision problem, but I didn't know what the problem was. So I called Kevin Ford because I knew his father, Leighton Ford, and I heard he had this consulting biz, and he said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to come in, and we're going to do an assessment of your church, and we'll try to figure out what's going on underneath the surface, and we'll be able to try to raise the issues. And I looked at him, and I said, Kevin, if I spend a lot of money with you, and you come back and tell me I got a vision problem, I'm going to fire you and talk bad about you. I'm really skeptical about what a consultant will do when you say this. And he came in and they did an assessment and they came in and they did the stuff that they do, which was really amazing. And they gave us this assessment. And Kevin came and he sat in my office and he looked at me and he said, here's the deal. You guys are scoring great. You're one of the healthiest churches we've ever seen. I mean, just incredible. But what's weird is everybody in this church, all they ever do is talk about you. They think it's about you. They think you did it. And they're worried about you leaving and what you want. And they're not quite sure that they have a part to play in it. What do you think about that? I wanted to throw up. I literally felt like I'd failed. Like, here I am. How did I make this about me? It's the last thing in the world I wanted to. I didn't do it intentionally. I didn't wake up in the morning going, you know, how can I get them to like me? But I had every marker. And here's what he told me. He says, and they're so happy with you, you don't have to do anything. You can send us home right now. Don't do anything. 10 years from now, when you want to leave, church will go into crisis. It'll spiral. They won't know what to do with themselves, but they'll just think even better of you. Those were the glory days when Todd was there. Or you could leave right now. Send them into crisis. They'll all have to jump up and they'll have to take care of things and immediately figure out who they are and what their ministry is and their mission is. I looked out the window, saw the ocean, looked at the picture of my kids. My daughter's still a ways from graduation. I said, is there something else? He said, you can learn a whole new way of leading, where it's no longer about what you want, but about what God's doing in and through you to the community. Because it's what's happening in the life of the church is that everybody thinks that you're the leader instead of Christ and his mission is the leader. And it means you're going to have to rethink and relearn every way you've ever learned to lead at a moment when everybody thinks you're doing just fine. And because I didn't want to leave, and because I liked it, we began the journey. My own transformation, my own having to be in the middle of a process of acknowledging how even though the church looked great on the surface, there was a growing lack of energy and passion because what people were saying, even though they weren't saying out loud, was, I don't know where my calling is in Todd's church. And we had to figure out how we gave it back to the people. Transformation begins with technical competence. I tell you that story because at one level, as we were talking about last night, guys like me and lots of folks who have churches that have grown get lots of credit for and get asked to do things like speak and stuff. But what I want you to know that now I look back at those days and I'm grateful for what we've done, but what I do think about them is they was just a matter of my being competent, of being competent enough to build trust and credibility with the people. And that I needed to figure out how to use that competence and turn it around. Lewis and Clark had the same thing. They were deeply competent people. Meriwether Lewis was an enlightened thinker. He was educated. He was a scientist. He had a philosophy background. He was a military and wilderness guide. They were perfectly tuned for this. William Clark had actually been Meriwether Lewis's superior. He was a military commander, a cartographer. He was experienced with tribes, experienced woodmen. They were two of the brightest people of the day, the two strongest people they possibly could have come, and they were incredibly competent. And for the first 18 months of their journey, all they did is demonstrate that competence over and over and over again. They ran a good ship. They didn't lose a single person. They had one person on this entire expedition die, and he died of an infection. They had one issue of insubordination that they dealt with swiftly and quickly. A person who was threatening to desert and had wandered off, and they brought him back, and they dealt with him in a way that everybody understood. They didn't get into any skirmishes. They did not have a single battle with the tribes until on the way back and in a moment of confusion. They had this incredible experience of being competent. They were great river folks. They handled the supplies well. They handled the people well. They were great scientists. They did their job. All adaptive change does begin in technical competence. Competence builds credibility. I say this because I want to make sure that we're clear that we need to be competent at what we do. Think about this. What are the technical competences necessary to be a church leader? It's not easy. It's the reason why we go to seminary and we get internships and we get experiences and we grow. And we've got to be able to handle the sense of handle things well and be competent. And I would say, if nothing else, in the words of Scott Kormode, there are some threshold competencies for transformational leadership. You have to be a good steward of scriptures and tradition. If people don't trust you with the scriptures, they're not going to trust you when you take them into uncharted territory. Very often, by the way, I want you to know that the technical quick fix of most churches is called change the preacher, right? The assumption, of course, is if things aren't going well, we're going to play fire the preacher. We're going to turn the preacher in for maybe a younger model or a more extroverted model or whatever. But the very common response is we can fix this by getting somebody better in the pulpit. Very often when I work with groups, my job is to help leadership get that you might have a problem with your preacher or your pastor, but if you don't go through a good process, you're probably going to repeat the same pattern. It makes sense why many churches that go through pastors go through multiple pastors time after time after time. Nonetheless, we have to be competent with the scriptures. John Calvin was actually way more gracious about this than you imagine. He actually has a section where he talks about the blessing of having a puny man preacher. That's what he calls it. He actually has a section in the Institutes where he talks about the blessing of a puny man preacher, that if you have a puny man preacher, meaning a person who's not particularly good, then what you can be assured of is it's the Holy Spirit that's transforming you, because it's certainly not that dude's sermons. They wouldn't do it, right? I wrote a blog post on this called Blessed Art Thou When the Sermon Sucketh. As a reminder that God does work beyond us, but I can tell you that if you go back into your congregation and you want to try to bring change and lead into uncharted territory, and you're not being faithful to the scriptures, faithful to the traditions, competent with your exegesis, working hard, your people are going to look at you before they ever pack their bags to head up over the Rockies. They're going to poke you in the chest and say, "Why don't you do better preaching?" And the same is true with being good stewards of souls and communities. We absolutely have to be good at care of souls, of caring for our people, of creating communities that are filled with care and love. If people don't feel connected and don't feel the sense of being loved by their pastors and loved, and the church doesn't have a sense of love and connection, they're not going on any journey, right? The only way we prepare for the future is by preparing for the quality of our relationships. And that also includes the health of the community. A bunch of the work we end up doing is just trying to put basic health into communities, getting people to speak the truth in love, to keep from gossiping or triangling, to put in healthy patterns of communication and conflict. Because if there's not health in terms of the way we deal with souls and communities, then there's no uncharted territory to head to. And also, there needs to be good stewardship of teams and tasks. Y'all know, I mean, it's interesting, whenever I watch a PNC, I've had several APNCs, associate pastor searches in the 16 years I've been there. And, you know, you can always tell the poor souls who just got out of doing their CPE, you know, where they wrote those things like, you know what I've discovered is the beautiful mystery and ministry of just sitting with people in their pain. I want to be about being and not doing. I want to be about staying with people and loving them in the journey. You know, to most lay people, they say, look at this and they go, they're lazy. We want someone who's going to come here and do some stuff. We want to make sure that they're going to run our children's program. They're going to make sure they're Sunday schools. They're going to make sure that they show up on time and care about the stuff and that they're going to be caring more about doing the job we're hiring them for. And there's something about the competence of handling our tasks well and our teams well. Scott Kormode says you don't have to be experts at these things, but you have to do them with enough credibility, enough competence, enough quality, so that ultimately these don't become the issues. There's a threshold level of competence. And I say this because what I want us to recognize that anything we do in terms of leadership stays grounded first and foremost in the personal assessment of the job and what we're doing. If the assessments come out that we need things to work on, then we need to be humble enough to work on them. Rule number one, leadership is about transformation that starts with the leaders, and it includes inner transformation and the assessment to continually grow in our own technical competence. Rule number two, no one goes into uncharted territory alone. Before there can be a discovery, there must be a core. Congruence leads to transparency, which builds trust. From technical competence, I want to add relational congruence, where we are ourselves in every place that we are, and that our relationships are consistent, that people know us and see us and trust us because we show up in every context exactly the person they expect us to be. One of the most powerful parts of Lewis and Clark's story is the people, the men they were. Now, here's one of the interesting backstories. Meriwether Lewis suffered from severe depression. If you know the end of his life, you know he committed suicide at the end of his life. But during these years, he functioned at an incredibly high level. Now, scholars have all kinds of studies, of theories about why there are gaps in his journals. But what Lewis and Clark were able to do together as a partnership, you know, they were known as Lewis and Clark. To this day, they're known as Lewis and Clark. You can be in Lewiston, Idaho, or Clark County, Kentucky, and not even know who they were named after, because we think of them together as Lewis and Clark. They were a great example of partnership. And here's one of the most interesting parts of their story. Meriwether Lewis outranked William Clark. William Clark, Lewis asked Clark, who had been his military superior, "Will you please come on this trip with me? I don't think I could do this without you. I need a partner, and you and I will be equal in all ways. I will go to the Congress and ask them to give you a full commission as a captain. We'll be equal partners in all ways." This was the military in 1803. And he wanted to have a complete co-pastorate, if you will, complete shared partnership. And Congress turned him down. Congress said they would not approve William Clark's commission. And Meriwether Lewis said to William Clark, "Then no one will know. And we're going to act like it anyway." And there's not one shred of evidence in any journal of anything that was reported that any of the men ever found out that Meriwether Lewis actually outranked William Clark. They were complete partners, absolutely to the very end. And in everything they did, all the way through the long upstream journey, all the way through the long winter, and finally, when they came to this amazing place, in one of the great stories about their background, which I won't tell you in all the detail tonight, but one of the great stories is they came to a place where the river took a huge fork. And they had to decide if they were going to get to the mouth, the source of the Missouri River, they had to make sure they didn't mess this one up. There were two huge streams. And they spent 3 weeks patrolling up both sides, trying to determine which one was the true Missouri River. Lewis and Clark each chose a stream, and then they turned to the men and asked them for their opinions, and all the men, to a man, chose the other stream. They all believed this far, this deep into the wilderness, that Lewis and Clark were wrong, completely and utterly wrong. And they wrote, one of the men wrote in his journal, "But we would happily follow them both being wrong." And they followed the two men up the stream, believing they were completely and utterly wrong, and yet they weren't. They were trustworthy and competent. Part of our work in bringing change is making our churches into what Heifetz and others call safe holding environments. Environments where the trust is so high, where we can have deep disagreements about which direction to go. And at the same time, the conditions of trust are so clear that we can ultimately trust and care for each other and live into those futures. Colin Powell writes, "Leadership comes down to creating conditions of trust within an organization." Most of you know that I spent the better part of 2 years working at the denominational level, which is a whole nother worthy of a whole nother weekend. And what I'm ultimately said in our report, the biggest part we said, the part that never got mentioned once on the floor of GA, what was the center of our, was that we believed that it was the crisis of trust that has been developed over years of regulatory answers to our deepest fundamental theological and value propositions. That we have used the Roberts Rules of Orders and regulatory mechanisms for so long that we did not know how to use healthy conflict to build trust. And it was the erosion of trust that would keep us from being able to move into our future. And it never once got discussed in either the committee or the floor of the General Assembly. I believe the pervasive lack of trust that is pervasive in so many churches and in our denominations is like this giant cancer that we're afraid to admit. If trust is there, trust is gone, the journey is over. Congruency leads to transparency, which builds trust. So how do you build trust? Ed Friedman says, rabbi, psychologist, organizational leader in Washington, D.C. for generations. His books are famous. Most of you have probably read them. Failure of Nerve is his most famous one. He said, the true leader is the one who is not blaming anyone else. When Ed Friedman used to do family therapy, he would invite the entire therapy family into therapy. They'd have a session together, and he would ask them, well, so what do you think's wrong with your family? And he'd let everybody talk. And whichever person in the family ultimately didn't blame anyone else but took responsibility for what was wrong in the family, he would do therapy with that person. Because he said that was the leader of the family. It didn't matter if it was a 12-year-old girl or a 17-year-old boy, or if it was mom or it was dad, whoever was not blaming anyone else, who was taking personal responsibility and yet showed up in the room and stayed connected to people, is the true leader of the family. How do you build trust? By taking personal responsibility. By staying focused and worrying about yourself and being not blaming anyone else. Staying calm enough to avoid quick fixes, to stay away from distractions and work avoidances, by being able to focus on your own ability to be congruent in every circumstance. So let me tell you a story. So I'm the It Takes a Church guy. If you ever read my book, you know that one of the things that I argue for is that at the very center of that Trinitarian community is the sacrament of communion, and that I believe deeply that the worship of the church should include communion every week. 12 years into my ministry, I still hadn't convinced our church to do that. 5 years into it, I was able to get it at one of the services, and I took some solace in the fact that Calvin also wanted it every week, and he never got it in Geneva either. But I began to ask the question about why this thing that was such a fundamental part of my theology, that was so much a part of my core conviction, that it was so much of who I was, why was I more successful at getting screens and drum sets than I was the sacrament? What was it that was keeping me from being able to lead our congregation through which I knew would be a difficult one? We don't have a bunch of folks who are lifelong Presbyterians. We have a bunch of folks who are lifetime non-denominational folks. I mean, and they mostly were pretty afraid of anything that felt too Catholic, especially from that guy whose grandfather's name is Guido Evangelisti. It took us 15 months of work, 15 months of conversation, theological conversation, conviction, discussion, practicing, more discussion, more conviction, 15 months of work. But after 15 months of work, we switched and were able to make the change. So that now at every one of our services every week, including Easter Sunday, we serve the Lord's Supper at every service. Now, I'm not telling you should do that, though that would be another seminar and I'm glad to come. But it was one of our deeply held convictions. So why could I live with so much incongruence for so long? Because nobody else cared about it as much as I did. And I, just like you, want to be liked, and I wasn't sure how much I wanted to push a congregation that wasn't sure it needed it or cared about it. That said some stuff like, you know, it'll be difficult to get that many volunteers every week. We're talking about the sacrament. It was only when I realized that I was out of congruence, that people were calling my church asking if I could come speak on how to put weekly communion into their congregations, that I would have to say I wasn't doing it. That led me ultimately to go through a journey of trying to let my congregation experience with me and join it in with me until we finally owned it together. It took 12 years for the sacrament. Just like you, I have my own red zone, right? I want to be liked, and I want to make sure that I have a job and that I get control over the things that I care about, and I want to make sure that I ultimately am seen as competent. But when we come to some clear convictions, clear shared missional convictions, this is what the mission of Christ is. This is who we are. This is what God's called us to. Then congruence is what gives us the credibility and the trust to move forward in those things. For many pastors, this means a lot of work on the difference between self and role. It's again my wife. My wife's work, especially when she works with women leaders and women leaders in the church. I mean, my wife does a lot of coaching of women in transition in the church who struggle hard with their identity because the church has not been good to a lot of women leaders about women pastoral identity. But for even for those of us as men, we confuse ourselves and our role all the time. You know, when someone tells us that we did a bad sermon, we hear, I'm a bad person. And on Sunday mornings, when people come out and tell me over and over again how much they love me when I do well, you know, I got a nice, kind congregation. When my sermon hits, they tell me they love me and that I did a good job. When my sermon's not good, they talk about the weather. We can always talk about the weather in San Clemente. It's good. But very, very often, after time, we can become people who are self and our roles are confused. I think about this all the time. I have a one key. I got what's called a one key. It's a key that will get me into actually any room in the church at any time. All except for one room, one place I can't get into. Everything else is mine. I got the one key. I can get into the kitchen where the cookies are. I can get into every room possible. I got it. And what I also discovered is with the run key, there's other things. I can actually go into any meeting at any time in the life of the church. I can walk into any meeting at any time, any Sunday school class, any place, and they will stop what they're doing and they will greet me. Hello. Matter of fact, I can walk up into any gathering, any place, of any group of people sitting on the patio having a conversation, and they'll stop what they're doing and they'll welcome me in. They'll do this all the time. It's amazing how often, how wherever I show up, people stop what they're doing and they welcome me. What I have to always remember is it's not me. It's the pastor they're welcoming. Because when I go home, my 16-year-old daughter, when I try that on her, she says, "Daddy, you're interrupting." Right? My role gets me into every room. My role gets me behind, lets me go behind hospital doors where nobody else can go. My role lets me go into holy places. It isn't about me. And at the same time, my role sometimes means that I have to speak the truth against people who don't want to hear it, or call people to places where they don't want to go. It's my role. And if I'm confused about between self and role, I'll end up being incongruent. You're not your role. You must bring yourself to your role, but you are not your role. Very often, the mantra we use, I've said last night, is the same. We need to be people to be congruent. We need to be people who can stay calm, monitoring our own anxiety, staying in the middle of decisions, staying connected, particularly with those people who are the most angry or disappointed in us, and ultimately stay the course. Living out our convictions, keeping the focus of effort on serving the mission, expressing convictions, and staying in relationship. If you do these two well together, you get the privilege of being a guide for people. They see that you're competent, and they trust you and want to follow you. Now, that's a big deal. You know, there's a lot of people who I'm very happy if they go backpacking by themselves. But if I'm going to let you guide my family, I want to know that both you're really competent and you also care about me. That you're going to not just flake out later, that you're going to be the same person that I interviewed if we're back in the backcountry and I need you. And that ultimately, the more we work on our own technical competence and relational congruence, we get the opportunity to begin the process of guiding people into the backcountry. Rule number one, leadership is about transformation. Transformation starts with leaders. Rule number two, no one goes into uncharted territory alone. Rule number three, transformation is fueled by trust. Transformational leadership begins in technical competence. I'm going to say one last piece about this. We wish that leadership began in character, but it doesn't. Most of us were hired before anybody knew really our character. We were hired because we had resumes or skills or abilities. They heard us preach. They had people listen to us. We were hired for our technical competence. It's one of the reasons why the most painful parts of why church life, when it goes wrong, or when a pastor has a moral failing or a theological failing, why there's a sense of betrayal. Because you don't actually get to know people well enough in an interview process to know if they really are relationally congruent people you can trust. That's up to us. Competence comes first, and then congruence. And over a long period of time of being a congruent, trustworthy person, then leadership becomes transformational with adaptive capacity. I said a lot about that yesterday, so I won't say much. But basically, just briefly review, the adaptive process is about getting up on the balcony, getting perspective, looking at the larger issues, seeing things that you wouldn't otherwise see because you're so distant from it, but continually listening to the floor, being both in the floor on the balcony, giving the work back to the people, transitioning from being the great answer giver to the great question asker, raising up the competing values, raising up the competing commitments, working together to see the underlying issues, being growth focused, leading people to grow, challenging them so that they can continue to grow. And that takes time. You know, one of the things we talk about all the time is people only grow as fast as they grow. They only learn as fast as they learn. If people have to develop a capacity, it isn't done until the capacity is developed. It just takes time. And the longer we're in people, I mean, there's a reason why. I think Lewis and Clark's Corps of Discovery was a whole different people after they'd gone all the way up the Mississippi River, all the way across the Missouri, spent an entire winter together in the Mandan tribe, and had crossed the Great Falls. By that time, I think they were ready for the mountains. And so for those of us who are in these processes of transformation, one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to be able to continually work on our competence? Do we want to continually work on developing the trust that's needed so that the day might come when we can face the future? Go with energy. As challenging as the notion I said yesterday about principles and people, is that I want to always encourage leaders to focus on those who are the mature and the motivated. There are always people who need to be cared for, and the church should create the environment to care for them. But if the bulk of your time is with the people who are complaining and resisting and angry and sabotaging and unhealthy and triangling, I want to suggest that perhaps you might be getting more out of it than you want to admit. The work is with the maturing, the motivated, the people who want to grow. Work with those who want to head over the mountain, and those who want to head over the mountain will take everybody else with them. Focus as much as you can on the mature and the motivated. It's difficult. I'm not saying it quickly. It's why it takes so much time, but it is exactly where you want to put our time. And lastly, be reminded this is always grief work. Leading means dealing with loss. As one other author said, growing up means giving up. If Western societies have become post-Christian mission fields, how can traditional churches become then missionary churches? Through transformed leaders. By being trustworthy. Trustworthy in both credibility and competence. Trustworthy in being relationally congruent. By building teams. By acknowledging that you don't do this by yourself. That there's a reason why Jesus had to do his own work on the cross and then poured out his spirit on the church. Y'all, the best thing I ever learned in seminary is that the yous are plural. Y'all are the people of God. Y'all are the temple of the Holy Spirit. Y'all. We live in such an individualistic world that even in Texas, y'all is now singular. You ever been to Texas? Now they talk about all y'all, right? We live in this deeply individualistic world. And we all believe that we're supposed to be the expert. I'm supposed to be Jesus. I'm supposed to be the one that gets it done. Or blaming, you're the one. It's all of us. Build teams, be trustworthy, and then lead into uncharted territory. Go. This is the moment. This is the day that we're to be about. One last thought I want to leave you with. I think there's a gift in the uncharted territory. I think it's the gift of the wilderness. Remember the story of Hosea when he says, I will woo you to the wilderness. I will take you back, O people of God, who have wandered away and back into the wilderness. You will be like a young couple in our first apartment who had no heat but found a way to survive the winter. They barely made it from paycheck to paycheck. But in that early days, we learned how to love and trust each other. I'll woo you to the wilderness. There's a reason why 1 Peter talks to a group of, probably a mixed group of Jews and Gentiles, probably mostly Gentiles, as if they're Jews, reminding them of their exile heritage. Because in those wilderness moments, in those moments when we get stretched beyond belief, we're transformed. One of the most interesting parts about the story of Lewis and Clark is how different a people they were. They left as two brash know-it-alls who were highly competent, knew the President of the United States, were given this, they expected they would come back to fortune and that they would come back to fame and that they would have any billet they ever wanted, and they were off on an adventure. It was a whole group of young men. They were all in their early 20s. And what became of them? They became the kinds of people who could listen to a Native American nursing mother so they didn't have to abandon their charge. They had a vote. The first vote in the new territory. They held a vote. They had a vote the winter about where they were going to spend the winter, in this place or Fort Clatsop. And they voted. And they gave Sacagawea and their slave York a vote. The first time a Native American or a woman or an African American voted was in Lewis and Clark's party. And they let a deserter go willingly. And John Coulter, who they let leave the party, something you'd never do in a military out, discovered Yellowstone. Uncharted territory will transform us. It's our moment. It's what we're about. It's the call of God, and it is the great incitement in front of us. But it means that we're going to have to relearn everything. The only question is, do we want to believe that God's going to call us and meet us there? That God's going to use your church and your place and your moment? We're going off the map. And we need an entire generation of folks who are just willing to go and learn how to go as they go. All right, I'll take questions. Dr. Bruner, should I start with yours? So why didn't we take a pay cut, right? Here's why we didn't take a pay cut. Because we decided, we spent 6 months working over the values for this budget. We got to it early. We saw the fact that the budget was coming, and we didn't wait till the last minute. We got to it early. We decided that one of our values is we were going to be rigorous about our mission, but we were not going to be ruthless. And we knew that if we waited longer, that the longer we waited, if the economy didn't turn around, the less generous we could be with the people that we had to let go. So the idea that we'll all take a pay cut and we'll try to make it do, we had absolutely no confidence that we could do enough pay cuts to make it through this recession. I guarantee you, if I think about how long it lasted, how long, and only in the last like month have we experienced anything coming back. It's been 5 years for us down there. We realized that what we needed to be able to do was we needed to make decisions based on our values. We also had gone through 12 years of building projects, so we'd have at least 6 of those years where our staff had not gotten raises. So they'd already fallen behind. I mean, I say, you know, people live, San Clemente's awesome, but I can't afford to pay, I can't pay anybody who can afford to live there. I'm the only one who makes a salary that can that where you can live in San Clemente. So what I got to do is create a church and create an environment that is so wonderful to be in that you want to be there, even if it costs you in sacrifice. And so what we had to decide was we could all sacrifice a bit more, but we just had no confidence that we'd be able to carry out our mission and continue on. So what we decided instead was we told every person, there's one of two things going to happen. Either you're going to get laid off and we're going to be as generous as we can with severance, or you're going to stay and then you're going to work harder than ever. So we're not going to cut your pay if you stay. And that was a decision we made. Now, not everybody did. And in other churches and other places, they could have different values than us. And it's really okay with me. Like every time I use this illustration, people think, oh, that's what you're saying I should do. Okay, so no, I'm saying we were trying to be very consistent with our values, and that was the decision we made. Now, I'm not sure they'll make that all the time, but that's why we did it. You're welcome. Are there other questions? Go ahead. Yeah. Right, competence builds credibility, right? And bad character does destroy community. So I agree with both those points. I agree to both of those. Good. How nice. Yes. What a brilliant, insightful comment. Thank you. So, Scott, go ahead. Right. Yeah. 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 Right. Well, there's a difference. One of the key statements we talked about at the very beginning was, you know, figure out what never changes and then be prepared to change everything else. Well, one of the things that we needed to say, I'm going to say this is a double negative. What we could never say would never change is that this church would always be built around Todd. right? One, it's not practical. Two, it's bad theology. Three, it makes me grossed out, right? So figuring out that I'm not a never change, what we had to get back to is what should never change in our church, what will never change. And what we got back to was our core values, our core theology. We're going to be a multi-generational community that is gathered and is committed to the scriptures. We're going to be as fundamentally connected to that as we possibly can. And what had become very clear to us is we were going to be as missional as possible. We'd made great strides and had a lot of transition that's allowed us to say our mission field starts at our parking lot, and we are going to reach out to our neighbors as much as we reach around the world, and we are going to be committed to that. Those values and the strengths of the people who are there is what we built on, but it meant that everything else had to be relearned. So we reshuffled the entire way we did stuff. I've got whole other stories I'll talk about the way we rearranged the way I had an executive staff, which I dismantled. We have a much more flat hire org chart. We have a much more collaborative model for a church our size. And to be honest, not everybody in the church likes it. There's all kinds of people that would just like me to call the shots because they think they can influence me easier than they can get groups of people together to mobilize people into ministry. So it means really changing the whole culture and practice. But it starts by building on your code, building on your own identity, and building on your own health and strength. So, okay, go ahead and look over here and I'll come back. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. So this is one of the issues that I have about the missional conversation is that I think it's the right theology. I actually think it's this great gift. I think all of us alive today in the middle of this conversation are going to consider ourselves blessed that we were around when the church in the West rediscovered itself, that its ecclesiology and its mission came together as the apostolate, that the church is the apostle to the world, that the central organizing principle of a community is the local church and mission. What's happened, unfortunately, is that's become really hard to transition. It's really hard to actually have people own that identity, that new identity, that reframe. And so what it's become is a program. And it's become a program that's been marked by like cliches. Like, well, this is on the tape, so I'll get in trouble. I think it's a false dichotomy to say attractional versus missional. I don't think that's the point. I mean, my point is the central organizing principle of the church the mission of God? Is it expressing apostolic witness of God in the community? So for us, what that meant was beginning to continually in a process of having to work with people who are very consumeristic, who've got lots of churches all around them that offer them lots of program, and who will say to us, why don't you meet our needs? And we spend a lot of our time regulating the heat behind how much we actually care, what we provide, what we do for, and what we also don't do, because we say our values are about discipleship happens in relationship. We build Christian community. We don't offer certain programs. I mean, we chose not to go multi-site. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It just didn't fit us. So I'll give you an example. Saddleback is in our backyard. And they started Saddleback San Clemente. And I had people come to me and say, oh my gosh, are you worried? I mean, they're going to be in your backyard and they're really cool and they're hip and they're great and they got, you know, bands and money and stuff. And I said, I'm no more worried now about Saddleback being in my backyard as I would be if the Episcopal Church planted a church in my backyard. If a Greek Orthodox Church planted a church in our backyard. Because they have distinct cultures. And what we've worked on in our church is developing a distinct culture. We're multi-generational. We're three generations all the time. Which means anybody who wants to be in a really homogeneous age group doesn't like us. And it's okay. There's a good older people, you know, older generation church. There's a really good baby boomer church. And there's all kinds of hip, you know, churches and bars that we're not, right? And so partly it's that identity living itself out as a mission. And for us, being missional means that identity drives everything we do, including changing everything else we do. So at one level, it may not look like it, but at another level, that central organizing principle is what we hold on to no matter what. That's the part that won't change. And I think the hard part about many CIFs is people say it, but you don't have much, what you realize is you don't have much evidence of people actually making hard changes. So the question I always ask is, so what are you not going to do? A strategic planning. The answer is, what are you not going to do? Once you're clear what you're not going to do, then you have a clear sense of what you're called to do. And most churches, they don't want to say they're not going to do something, right? Because we want at the one odd chance that, you know, like, I mean, just I sometimes start with the absurd. You know, we're not going to minister to extraterrestrials. So we're not. So check that one off. But people who want to proclaim Jesus as King of the universe want to leave that open. So, I mean, you know, but it gets more as we go down. Okay, so let me come over here and then I'll go back there.
What if the core value of the church is we just want to love ourselves?
Okay, good. So here's a question. Yeah, this is awesome. I love that you said this, okay? My number one question, I don't bring this up but you brought it up, so thank you. Okay, so what if the DNA of the church is really not very biblical? Talk to some of our older friends who were in the South about having racist DNA in their churches or other things, right? So what if the DNA isn't very good? Well, here's the question. So how do you change DNA? You know the answer? Sex. You birth something new. A pastor and a group of people come together and they love each other enough and trust each other enough that they birth something new that's not them. The biggest problem I have with most pastors that I coach who say, problem with my church's DNA is that they're this, is I think, if you don't love them, they're never going to want to get close enough with you to birth anything. Trust, congruence over a long period of time. It's not going to look like you. It's not going to look like your congregation. It's going to be something totally new. We change the DNA over a long period of time through building relationships, love, and birthing something new. In the back, you have, go ahead. Well, the one book I gave you was Jim Osterhaus's Thriving Through Ministry Conflict. I just want to say that one again, lift that up. The second book I would do, and somebody else asked me this earlier, so I did think, Gil Rendell's book, Journey Through the Wilderness, is one where he uses the wilderness motif, not quite as sexy as Lewis and Clark as far as I'm concerned, but it's a really excellent, excellent book. Gil Rendell's book is a good one. And then I really do believe that a lot of the work of the missional leadership folks, well, they don't necessarily use adaptive. Alan Roxburgh does talk about it, but he doesn't apply it in some of the similar ways. And frankly, it's the reason why I'm going to write a book this summer. So stay tuned, hopefully. You know. But the ones I would refer back to a lot are Kevin Ford's The Transforming Church, Jim Osterhaus, Gil Rendell. Those would be the three that I would say right off the bat that I would have you look at. And then there are a missional leader by Alan Roxburgh has some stuff in it too that I think is helpful. And some of the rest of you may have others, so feel free to, I don't know, put comments on my blog, and when people go to download stuff, they can find those books too. So, go ahead.
What about when your session is just so tired?
Yeah. They're tired. Yeah. So one of the things I would do is I would say to you, give that tiredness back to the session. Give that problem. Raise the problem. Look, here's the problem I have. I really believe when I read these scriptures, bring the scriptures to them. Read John 20. Talk about what it means to be sent. I really believe this is what it means for us to be this. I believe this. But what I also believe is I love you and I'm committed to you. I'm here to be your pastor. So we're caught. You're the session. We're charged with the nurturing governance of the church. What should we do about it? Like for so many, again, I keep wanting to say, what if you're the only one being kept up at night by this, you've got to figure out how to let other people into the problem. And so I would say, keep bringing it back. I wouldn't let it go. I mean, this is part of turning up the heat. I would teach it, preach it, talk about it, raise it, but I'd be as compassionate as possible and be as transparent as possible. Look, we're tired. I mean, that's ultimately what we got to. It was, you know, it's interesting. I say this example, you know, our church is one of TAG's poster churches. You know, my elders didn't want to pay for TAG to come in. I paid for it. Now, I happen to have a fund that because we'd sold a bunch of my books, we put some money there. I said, we'll pay for it. Well, then the session went, okay. 6 years later, we're doing it again and they're paying for it. There's places along the way where I felt like we met them, we talked about things. They were tired. They'd finished a building project and, you know, there were people looking at me like, you got a sabbatical, we didn't, you know. But we had to keep owning the ministry and giving it back to them. So give it back to them. Okay, we're almost done. Okay, over here, Mike. Celebrating small wins along the way, paying attention. I feel like it's not one of my strengths, by the way. It's why I always need people like you on my staff. because literally, I need people around who remind me, hey, Todd, hey, how about cheering? You know, like, hey, we did well. You know, I'm always like, next! You know, so it's not one of my strengths, but it's hugely important, you know, being able to lift up our eyes, see the things that God's done, recount the stories, talk about it. You know, every now and then, even part of the reason why I do this is I get to tell the stories about my congregation. They choke me up. They're just this amazing group of people who I love deeply because of this journey they've been on with me. And sometimes I don't tell them enough. I mean, honestly, I don't. All right, one more. There we go. You get it. Yeah. Yeah, you know what? I think how do you balance time between the balcony and the dance floor? One of the things is just acknowledging that you need both, right? And so I actually do this kind of physically. My dance floor is our patio between services. And I literally force myself out there. I mean, between services, I'd much rather sit back and prepare my talk for the next hour. Make sure I get it down because that's, competence is my red zone. So I want to make sure I do a good sermon. But what I need to do is spend time out there listening. And I literally try to build into our team an awareness of, are we getting enough time on the balcony? Are we listening enough? Are we spending enough time listening? It's just a constant discipline. And I say it's exhausting. It's like, remember, you know, Bear Bryant was famous as a football coach for having that tower that he, stood in as he looked over the field because they didn't have the NFL All 22 at the time. And I just kept thinking, you know, if he wanted to give anybody instructions, he either had to yell or he had to, like, run up and down the tower. And I'll bet you as a young man, he ran up and down the tower, and I'll bet as an old man, he just yelled, right? But I think it's exhausting. We got to keep going down, being in the lives of people, listening, getting feedback, and then getting back up above it and getting perspective, looking at the deeper issues, and just paying attention to it. It's just work. I think it's like one of the primary work. So, all right. Okay, I'm going to let you both have the last two, and then you are done. So you go here and then here. I know, and I wish I was more helpful. I do, and I hope that maybe as I learn and grow, I'll be more helpful.
And I want to tell you, you've been helpful.
Yeah,
to me.
I know, but I get, I understand. I understand. I do. I do. Either town, right. Yeah, this conversation is so important. This needs to happen over and over and over again. It's one of the reasons why I say, you know, you can't go into uncharted territory alone. We need these kind of conversations happening all the time because I realize everything's contextual, right? And if I'm in Denali and I'm making up rules for Yosemite, it isn't going to work. And we have got to have more of these conversations. And I would just be the first one to admit that I'll be a learner in that. I'm going to continue to be. So.
The issues of rural America
are totally. Yeah, they're huge. And very different, very different. You bet. In the back, you, Glenn, I think it was you, right?
Yeah.
The young, yeah, the younger folks. So, okay, so here's the quick story about the young group that I got into. What I basically discovered is that what we did is we did, Phyllis Tickle has this illustration where she says that every 500 years, the church has to have a rummage sale, that it needs to basically go up and rattle around up in the attic and ask yourself, do we want to keep this or not? Or, hey, this is interesting. That used to be used as a hat rack. Maybe today we could use it as a planter. And what I basically did is I got a group of people together and I asked them to tell me about their experiences, and I asked them if for 4 months we could do basically a theological rummage sale, where I could ask them to tell me what concepts of your faith, because they were all had been people who had all been in the church at one time, what concepts of your faith do you want to hang on to? What do you feel like you want to chuck? And what do you feel like need could be adapted for a different thing? And what I found is that what came out of it was there wasn't any one solution. What it was is the conversation itself was something none of them had ever experienced. So what happened with that group is two of the couples ended up coming back to our church. Another couple in that group decided to become part of our starting a Monday night gathering that is the beginning of our next of the 1001 worshiping communities that we're trying to figure out how to do. And two others basically kind of went away and said, we're going to figure out other ways to be involved in loving Jesus in the community and probably won't be in the organized religion. There was no solution, but the conversation was huge. I would say that nothing came out of it except that a middle-aged pastor got a chance to listen to some young adults and realized that all the solutions we tried up to this point were really going the wrong direction. That programming for this group wasn't gonna work, and that we needed to go have them work with us on the solutions, and that's began to happen. Now that's so. The reason I was hesitant to use it is it's we're 6 months into it. So check with me 6 months from now. Maybe I'll tell you something else. So it's just so new to us. All right, I'm gonna close by praying for all of you, praying for us. We'll be done. Oh Lord, I pray that you will give us both urgency and hope. If the church could make it through the Black Plague, it can certainly make it through post-modernity. And if we need to simply surrender our expertise or our position or our power and allow you to raise up something new, we pray that you would. I pray that you would give us the vision of Isaiah 11:1, that there will be a new shoot from an old root bearing fruit, that there would be new branches that would come and bear fruit, that they would be miraculous, and that you'd allow us to see it and be part of it. I pray for every pastor in every context, and for every one of us who, whether we have an official role or not, are sitting in a congregation, that you would give us eyes to see and that you would help us to be people who encourage people to head over the mountains. I pray for those of us who are near the end of our ministries and formal ways, that you would give us a charge for what we're to be in terms of mentoring and supporting, affirming, growing up, standing alongside those who are at the beginning. I pray that when this conference is 80 years old, that they'll look back at this day and they'll marvel at what a group of people who deeply have trusted and loved each other were able to do because they gave themselves to them, to you and to each other. And it'll be totally different. Give us your hope and give us your power until that day and when the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ, and he shall reign. Hallelujah. 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 Amen.